Innovation Task Force, today being Monday, December 2nd, 2019. And welcome, everybody. I trust all your pies and leftovers. And we have jumped into winter with a grand start, not a good harbinger for us in Minnesota. But then I got married on January 6th, and it was 40 below, so I figured all uphill from there. We certainly have a great report that I know we've been really looking forward to having in front of us. But first, I'll recognize Senator Jasinski to move the adoption of the minutes.
Madam Chair, I'd move the approval of minutes from October 29, 2019 meeting.
Thank you very much. Members, any changes, any issues with the minutes at all? Seeing none, I'll proceed to vote. All those in favor say aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Thank you very much. So our main item on the agenda today is the vehicle registration funding methods. And very happy to be at this stage and be getting into the meat of the information. So, Ms. Schrodel, are you going to present or just introduce and then maybe just give us an idea of how you're going to proceed?
Sure. Madam Chair, I'll just do a quick introduction. And thank you all. We will have our budget director from MnDOT, Josh Kanadrud-Hubinger, and Tony Anderson from DPS presenting the majority of the information. We have pulled together a coordinated effort with the Department of Public Safety and been working over the last month since the last task force on various scenarios. And we'll have a little bit of background information, and we'll provide some of the scenarios on the basis that was prescribed in statute for the task force to review. We are actually anticipating receiving the weight data in the next couple weeks, so we will be back to present some of that information and any other combination of scenarios that the task force would like us to pursue. So with that, I guess I'd like to turn it over to our presenters and have them move through the presentation.
Thank you very much, Ms. Schrodel. And so with that, we will welcome Mr. Kanadrud-Hubinger. Welcome. And also Mr. Anderson. Always good to see a variety of divisions working together to get information to us on the task force. Okay. With that, why don't you go ahead, Mr. Kanadrud-Hubinger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Josh Kanadrud-Hubinger. Very close on pronunciation, not bad. I am the budget director at MnDOT.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tony Anderson, program director with Driver and Vehicle Services.
Welcome. Glad to have you here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I will proceed with the presentation. We have some background information just to level set how we compare to other states, and then we'll walk through three of the four scenarios prescribed in statute, like Christy Schrodel mentioned. We are working on getting the weight data that should be available in the next couple weeks, and then we'll be ready to come back with that information as well as any hybrid scenarios that this committee would like to see. And again, there's a lot of information in this report that is intended for background. We won't go through it in detail today, but it is there for your information. And if you have questions, I don't know if you'd like for format to ask questions as we go or wait until the end. Madam Chair, I'll just proceed unless there are
questions. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. So again, registration taxes in Minnesota are dedicated to transportation in the Constitution. The language is on the slide. It goes to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund along with motor fuel taxes and the motor vehicle sales tax. And then from there, it is divvied up via formula in the Constitution. 62% goes to the Trunk Highway Fund, 29% to counties, and 9% to cities over 5,000. Just to level set for the magnitude for the revenues, this is fiscal year 18. The revenues that were deposited in that Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, or HUTD.
I'm sorry to interrupt you just a moment. Our microphones in the Senate, you have to really get close and speak directly. Yes, but just really lean into it and get as close as you can.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that better?
Much better.
All right. I apologize for that. So again, gas taxes are still the largest source of revenue in the HUTD fund, followed closely by registration taxes or tab fees. Right now, they comprise about 35% of the total revenues in that fund, or close to $800 million in the last fiscal year. And you can see at the bottom how those funds are distributed to the Trunk Highway Fund, counties and cities, et cetera. Most of the focus for registration taxes will be looking at Minnesota Statute 168.013. This is where the different distributions or the taxes for each type of vehicle class is spelled out in detail, along with some of those subdivisions or sections that are going to make changes that are proposed via this task force a little challenging. And we'll get into that in a little bit. For passenger vehicles and pickups, and again, this is just passenger vehicles and pickups, the tax is a base $10 plus 1.25% of the vehicle's base value, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And then that base value is depreciated over 10 years, going down 10% each year. So in the first year, you pay 1.25% of the entire base value. In year two, it's 90%. Year three, it's 80%, and so on over 10 years. And then in that 11th year, you pay a minimum $25 additional tax, so a total of $35 in year 11 and beyond. Passenger vehicles and pickups are what that depreciation schedule applies to. There are various tax rates for the other types of vehicles that are on the roads in Minnesota. These are just some illustrative examples. Motorcycles pay a fixed $10. Trucks and tractors pay based on a graduated scale, based on weight, ranging from $120 all the way up to almost $1,800. And these other vehicles generate about 20% of that nearly $800 million of registration taxes. Won't go through this in detail, but just to kind of level set, those top two lines, this is the detail of all the different types of vehicles in Minnesota. This is from calendar year 18. 7 million plus individual vehicles, and you can see the various mix. There's 30 different classes of vehicles. What we're talking about today is focused on those top two, passenger vehicles and pickups. And although they make up about 80% of the revenue, there are a variety of other vehicles that you can see here that different rates apply as well. And so again, just to remind people, we are just going to focus on passenger vehicles and pickup trucks. For those two vehicle classes, there are currently about 4.9 million vehicles in the state of Minnesota for about 4 million licensed drivers. The average age of those vehicles is nearly 12 years now. And 44% of those vehicles are 11 years or older and are paying that minimum $35 tax. A little bit of detail on electric vehicles. And when we're talking about electric vehicles, we're talking about pure battery-powered electric vehicles. There are also plug-in hybrid electric vehicles. As of January 1, 2018, there is a $75 surcharge that gets paid in addition to those registration taxes. There are currently about 5,300 pure battery-powered electric vehicles. If you include plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, there's a little over 10,000 as of June. So again, there's always this discussion about electric vehicles are taking over. Right now, those vehicles are about 0.2% of the entire fleet. But on the flip side, they've been growing. Those vehicle sales have been growing about 85% a year over the last 3 years. So currently a very small portion, but growing very fast. That $75 surcharge currently is not tracked separately in our accounting system. So we're just doing rough math. That surcharge collects about $400,000 in additional revenue to the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund. Again, a relative drop in the bucket. But again, the potential growth rate, 20% of Americans say their next vehicle will be electric. And just for comparison's sake, two of our neighboring states also have electric vehicle surcharges. In Wisconsin, it's $100, and in Iowa, it's $25. This slide is just to show the mix of the age of the vehicle versus what percent of the revenue they pay. And again, this is connected to that depreciation schedule. So 6% of the fleet are essentially new cars, but because of the way that schedule works, they pay almost 20% of the total revenue. And then on the other end of the spectrum, vehicles that are 11 years or older are about 47% of the fleet. And again, there's a slight disconnect in some of these numbers. When we're talking about revenue, we're using our most recent forecast. And in some other cases, we're using a more current snapshot of the fleet we received from DPS. So if you're wondering, a couple slides ago, 11-plus vehicles are 44%. That's the more current look. This 47% is from February. But about half of the vehicles are 11 years or older, and because of that minimum tax of $35, they only pay 13% of the total registration taxes. Just so you can see the relative mix of the different primary revenue sources in the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund, registration taxes are that red in the middle, have paid about 30% to 40%, or generated about 30% to 40% of the registration tax, of the total revenue in the Highway User Tax Distribution Fund over the past 20 years. And you can see motor fuel taxes have been paying a slightly declining share of those total revenues as registration taxes and motor vehicle sales tax have generated more. And again, we've already covered this, but just a reminder as we go into the scenarios, we're just talking about passenger vehicles and pickups. Those vehicles generate about 80% of the total revenue. The other 20% has a variety of different taxes for the utility trailers, the motorcycles, the buses, and those will not be discussed in the scenarios we're about to review. This is just some details so you can see the relative growth year over year for the passenger vehicles and pickups in terms of revenue. That very bottom line, been growing in the 4% to 5% range the past few years. The current forecast from last February is for that to slow down a little bit to 1% to 2% as new vehicle sales flatten out. I believe you've already seen this slide in prior presentations, but just again, as a reminder, the National Conference of State Legislatures has a very handy map of how every state taxes registration taxes or vehicles. The color coding is fairly easy to follow, although I will qualify that in some cases there's a combination of those different taxes for states. As an example, Iowa is color coded as value-based. They apply a hybrid value-based and weight-based tax. So just when you're looking at that map, a little caveat. And from that map, just a count for context, half the states use a flat rate, and again, that rate varies significantly. About 14 states used a weight-based rate, 7 used a value-based, which is what we would fall under. And again, we would be considered a value and age-based rate hybrid. And 10 states use some combination of the various types. Focusing a little more on our neighbors, they're very much a mixed bag. Iowa uses a value and weight-based approach. So similar to us, it's 1% of the value for, and then has a depreciation schedule, not consistent like ours where it goes down 10% each year. For Iowa, it starts at 1% for the first 7 years, then it's 0.75% for years 8 and 9, 0.5% for 10 and 11, and then a fixed $50 beginning in year 12. And then on top of that value-based tax, they add a 40 cent for every 100 pound weight tax on top of that. North Dakota is weight-based, ranging from $50 to $274. South Dakota is also weight-based and ranges from $36 to $144. And Wisconsin has a flat rate of $75. We were working off NCSL data for what we used here. Wisconsin just increased their rate from $75 to $85 in October. And again, going back a couple slides for how the different states use a variety of approaches, even when you look at just the age-based, the number of years that it applies can vary significantly. So here in Minnesota, beginning in year 11, we have a fixed tax of $35. This is meant to be illustrative across these five states. You can see the year in which some version of a minimum tax applies is as early as year 5 in Colorado and as late as year 17 in Oklahoma. And then that minimum tax also varies in that year from a low of $15 up to $45, or $50, excuse me. This is a list of states that have utilized the FAST system in recent years and kind of how their revenue picture compares to us, just for the difficulty of implementing a new system, whether the revenues are constitutionally or statutorily dedicated, and what percent registration taxes contribute to that state's transportation revenue. And I will turn it over to Tony for just a moment to talk about some of the other states and their experience with FAST.
Thank you, Josh. So the data from this slide here came from the project directors that are working directly in, for example, Oklahoma, Massachusetts, or Nebraska.
You'll need to really lean into that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Very soft-spoken as well. So the information here was feedback from the project directors that are working with FAST at the specific jurisdiction. So Oklahoma, Massachusetts, and such, we received the data from their project director. There are a couple states that are missing, Oklahoma and Washington for one, but this was kind of feedback from the jurisdictions on what they've worked with in regards to FAST Enterprise.
Keep that mic close. The next couple slides are just, we just looked at how we compare to neighboring states. This is just for specific vehicles, so you can get a sense of what those taxes actually are. First is a Toyota Camry. With a $26,000 value and a 3,300-pound weight. And the kind of color coding here is if it's red and bold, that means in that neighboring state it's more expensive in that same year than in Minnesota. So in Minnesota, for this Toyota Camry in year one, you pay $335. It works its way down over that 10-year depreciation schedule. And then in year 11 and beyond, it's a fixed $35. You can see in Iowa, it's kind of a similar start relatively high and work its way down. And then in Wisconsin, there's that fixed $75. And again, the reminder that will now be $85. And in South Dakota, where it's weight-based, that 3,000-pound curb weight translates to about a $72 essentially fixed rate for this Camry. And so if you're looking at just those three neighboring states, South Dakota and North Dakota are fairly similar, so we left North Dakota off. Iowa is significantly higher than Minnesota, and then Wisconsin and South Dakota are about half as much as Minnesota. And then again, same layout, but for a Nissan Rogue, a relatively small SUV. And again, here the story trends the same. Iowa's a little more expensive. Wisconsin and South Dakota are about half as much. But again, you can see because this Rogue weighs a little bit more, it doesn't change the value for South Dakota, but in Iowa, it's a higher value and a heavier vehicle, so this vehicle pays a little more. And one last example for a pickup truck in F-150. The most expensive of the three examples at $42,000 and over 4,000 pounds in weight. So again, here you can see Iowa pays more. Wisconsin is that same fixed amount, but now in South Dakota, you go from paying $72 to $108. We're going to talk a little bit about a couple of the definitions in statute that have also been raised in some of the OLA audits and recommendations, just so everyone is again aware of the issues for a couple of these components. So vehicle value, the 168.013 defines what base value is, and it's list price plus destination charge. And then as an alternative, which this task force is looking at, manufacturer's suggested retail price, or MSRP, would be just essentially that sticker price. Destination charge, which is also spelled out in that statute, is included currently in base value. OLA did, in their report, highlight that there is no single source for base value data, which results in variability and inconsistency. Destination charge adds another wrinkle on top of this. It's about $800 per vehicle as an estimate, and just if we were to propose removing that destination charge and just go with MSRP, it's about 1% of total revenue for that destination charge. The estimates for years 2020 through 23 are if that were removed starting in fiscal year 20. And it does have a compound effect because it applies in year one, and then it's more vehicles that it's applying to in each year. So you can see over the next 4 years, if that went away, it's, again, 1% of revenue, not material, but it is about $23 million over 4 years. One other component of the statute that may need to get looked at, the hold harmless provision. This is in subdivision 1AJ, and this is that provision that if the registration tax cannot exceed what you paid the year before for previously registered vehicles. And again, the significant component here is if this task force recommends changes where the mix of what a vehicle pays would change significantly, if this provision still existed, it would result in a pretty significant reduction in revenues because you couldn't, for example, switch from value-based as current to increasing to a flat base rate for older vehicles without losing revenue if this still exists. So now to the scenarios. So as Christy Schradl mentioned, we have three of the four versions that were recommended in the statute. We will discuss today the flat rate, the age-based rate, and the value-based rate. We will get weight data. We currently do not collect that as part of the MNLAR system or previous systems because it does not have any direct connection to the current tax structure. But we are working with a third-party provider to get that information for all 4.9 million passenger vehicles and pickups in the next week or two. And so we can come back to this committee within a couple weeks and present that scenario. And just for all three of the versions we're going to discuss today, the assumptions are over the next four fiscal years, starting in 20 out through 23, these changes will result in a essentially revenue neutral outcome. We did make one change across all these scenarios and assume that the life of the vehicle is 12 years. So for example, in the age-based rate, we depreciated over 12 years instead of the current 10 to more closely align with that 12-year life of the vehicle. So as I briefly mentioned at the beginning, we did get a very detailed new snapshot of all vehicles in the state of Minnesota within the last couple weeks. For everyone's sake, the data quality of those records looks very good. There's over 8 million vehicle records. Not a whole lot of outliers when you look at like the vehicle age or the value. Of course, with that many records, there are some, but very minimal, less than 0.1%. And so for any of these scenarios, we excluded those where they were obviously incorrect. And then, as I mentioned already, the weight data that we did get with this data set, there is some weight data that already exists, but again, it's about half of the vehicles have it, which is why we don't have a weight scenario today. Flat rate, this is pretty easy. If we transition to a flat rate that every vehicle pays, it would go from that wide variability to a $138 per vehicle.
Can I just ask you again, so now you've gone from data quality into if a kind of a scenario, like you said. So if we did a flat rate in order to keep it revenue neutral, that would be the dollar amount for each vehicle, passenger, pickups, everything. Is that right?
Madam Chair, that is just for passenger vehicles and pickups. So all these scenarios are not including all those other types of vehicles that account for about 20% of the total revenue. So we are not looking at motorcycles. Those are different sections of the statute. So this would just be if we changed 168.013, that depreciation schedule for just passenger vehicles and pickups.
And this passenger and?
And pickups.
Okay, pickups, right, okay. Those.
So this is about 4.9 million of those 8 million okay. vehicles.
Yes, Representative Petersburg.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to clarify. So are you assuming then that we would not be using the hold harmless rate for this flat rate?
That's correct.
Yes.
Thank you.
That's in your assumption here, right, Mr. Natterberg? Sorry, so sorry. Natterberg Hubinger, excuse me. So the $138 flat tax rate, that is assuming we would, in year one, move totally over to that and make that a change. There was some conversation, Representative Petersburg, about a legacy table and then a new table, but the assumption here is that year one, everybody would move to that flat rate.
Madam Chair, that is correct. I will clarify again for everyone's sake, all the scenarios are just for passenger vehicles and pickups. they assume the hold harmless provision is removed so that it'd be revenue neutral over the next 4 years. The effect of leaving hold harmless would just be a phased in. We'd get to comparable revenue sources in a couple years, but there would definitely be 2 to 4 years where there would be a significant impact, a revenue loss, if we did not remove the hold harmless. These assume we do.
Right, because of the hold harmless, there would have to be that legacy table to follow through with that. Okay, that's what I was concerned about. All right. So even on year one, you would have a hold harmless table, you'd continue to follow that, and then others would go under this flat rate scenario.
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Okay.
If we maintained the hold harmless provision, then there would be a phased-in effect. These scenarios are all based assuming year one hold harmless is removed. And so, for example...
Okay. So on your scenario here, that is presupposing no hold harmless. I think that's an important note. So this assumption here is year one or whenever it takes effect, everybody move right over into the flat rate. Okay. Just want to be sure because that's such a critical thing to understand the underlying assumptions of any scenario. All right.
Madam Chair, that's, and again, the easy example is right now a year 11 vehicle pays $35. They would go from $35 to $138 in year one under this assumption. And again, if we maintain a hold harmless, it would just be a phased in.
Okay, we have a couple years. Oh, okay. All right, you can go ahead.
And the layout for the rest of this presentation is very similar. So for each scenario, we just have a high-level summary of what the impact would be. And then for that illustrative Toyota Camry and that F-150, we just compare current law to what it would look like under the new rate. And again, you can see those older years right now that are paying $35 would transition immediately to that new, in this example, flat rate of $138 towards the bottom of this table.
Okay. Members, any questions on the flat rate base comparison? Again, this is without the hold harmless for current vehicles. Okay, you can go ahead then.
And again, this is just that same data in chart form. So you can see the sloped line is the current tax rate. That flat rate line would be the new rate. And again, in this example, pretty easy to follow what the change would be. Newer vehicles would pay less. Older vehicles would pay more.
So question I have here was if we kept the hold harmless, then these are just runs of scenarios. So if we did a flat rate but continued the hold harmless until all the vehicles run off of that table, did you do any comparison of that at all using the hold harmless?
So, Madam Chair, this example would be where that hold harmless would have the most impact.
In this flat rate?
Correct, in the flat rate, because those old vehicles that make up over 40% of the fleet, if hold harmless exists, they would never transition to this new rate. The other methods, a lot more of those vehicles would apply because there are different factors. So this would be the most aggressively impacted from maintaining hold harmless. And we do not have anything in this presentation about that dollar impact. We can certainly provide that.
I just, Commissioner, I'll just carry. So on that whole idea, though, it's something that I think is really important to me, that as it's a transition that has a lot of sticky issues and the hold harmless during the time of the origin of that particular car during that period of time, okay? So that would make meaning that instead of moving everybody right over, you would have the hold harmless in place until that vehicle is off, gone, no longer around, and then you would then everybody would move into the flat rate. So there's no scenario that you've run using the hold harmless under flat rate where you would keep that legacy.
Madam Chair, that is correct. There's no detail in this presentation about the impact of hold harmless. The easy way to think about it is because vehicles last about 12 years, it's about a 12-year transition period.
Okay.
But we could certainly come back and provide that.
So Madam Chair, I think that the budget team at MnDOT is happy to provide that information. I think it's just fair to say at this point, if the goal is to not harm the transportation system, you would need to make a set of decisions, legislators and the governor, around backfilling those dollar amounts, probably, likely, with some sort of general fund or one-time dollars through that period of time and then back it off. And so it is possible to do that, but it will set a set of decisions in motion that, and for each of these scenarios, that could make that happen. We wanted to stick to what was prescribed in the legislation around the task force, but are happy to provide what that gap would be.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. I think the challenge is to get to a certain point where we get this data, and then, but I think the big thing is understanding the implications. Exactly, Commissioner. Representative Elkins?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other observation I'd like to make as well is that if you read the OLA report on transactional accuracy closely, it's clear that the current hold harmless clause, as it's currently written, is a major cause of transaction inaccuracies, in part because with our current value-based system, it makes it impossible to correct a misapplied value. So you had that one extreme example where a Ford F-150 vehicle had been valued at $2, and basically that person got $35 registration fees for the life of their vehicles. So, and then the other thing that I think that if they were going to go down this path, it would have to be evaluated is that I strongly suspect that if we maintained bifurcated rate structure with grandfathered and not grandfathered, it would tremendously complicate the programming challenge.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. Those are all the factors we need to consider. Thank you. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Elkins got to a point that I was going to sort of ask about in terms of the agenda and this discussion, if Mr. Anderson or somebody is going to be, if today is the day where we're going to start having that conversation, because I was having the same thoughts, this idea of running on parallel paths with two totally separate ways of doing this sounds like real problems in waiting, and that's something we really do need to understand. So I don't know if that's going to be something we're going to be able to talk about today or if that's for down the road.
Well, Senator Kent, I think the whole point is to have as much data as possible, and absolutely, that's the whole point of our task force, is to have that robust discussion. So I believe it is appropriate. Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not sure who this is, maybe Mr. Edward Hubinger, but I know you said vehicles or passenger cars and pickups. Does that include the one-ton farm truck, excuse me, that's paying the flat tax now, or does that not include that?
It does not. Chair, it does not.
Thank you.
So just to clarify, if we look back to one of those charts that you had earlier, there were two lines on top. One was passenger and one was the pickup trucks. And then below that are those who would not be in this scenario or in any of the scenarios, is my understanding. Those are all very specific. All of us who've served in transportation, all of those other areas are very, very specific criteria. And as you've explained, exists another chapter of law. Well, members, with that, I think we can go ahead and continue the presentation. And I just always want to make sure as we go through that an accurate understanding of your presentation. So you can go ahead and go to the next scenario.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So one down, two to go. If we used an age-based rate, so here we applied a similar logic to the way the structure currently works, except that we extended the number of years from the current 10 out to 12 years. And again, this is to align with what a national economic consultant says the average vehicle life is. It's now about 12 years. So we basically started with a fixed rate in year one that then goes down about 10% each year over 12 years. And then in year 13 and beyond, it goes back to that existing $35 minimum tax. So again, for the two illustrative examples, here's how that would compare. You can see for a Toyota Camry going from a value-based, kind of value and age-based hybrid, that's the current model, to an age-based year one is essentially the same rate. And then it just goes down over that similar schedule, except that in year 10 and 11, years 11 and 12, they are still under this depreciation schedule essentially, whereas in the current structure, it stops in year 10. And then for an F-150, if we go to age-based, where value is not a component, that expensive F-150 gets a significant reduction in the early years and then pays a little more in older years. So here's how they compare in chart form. You can see they're relatively similar. It's that new age-based rate would be spread out over a couple more years, which is why there's that additional those additional costs in years 7 through 12.
Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And forgive me, I may have just been reading and should have been listening when you said this. So the starting points for the two cases, the 325 and the 525, what's the basis for those two different vehicle classes?
Go ahead, Mr.
Chair. Madam Chair, Senator Kent. Those are the under the current structure. So the Camry and the F-150 are paying a percentage of the vehicle value, which is why that F-150 starts at 525 and the Camry starts at 325.
And Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator.
So just to clarify then, this is still essentially a hybrid value base because that's still part of the starting point, but then it's the depreciation is age-based?
Yes, Mr. Natterud-Hubinger. What we need to know is what are those assumptions that were used in making the calculation on this table? What were those assumptions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to clarify, the current structure is a hybrid value and age-based. So that's the column one for the Camry and then for F-150. And so the F-150 under the current law pays significantly more because it's more expensive. This scenario for transitioning to just an age-based, there's no connection to the value whatsoever. So this is just every vehicle starts at that same $315 and then goes down over 12 years. And so it works its way down in a similar fashion to the current structure, but it's all based on age. There is no connection to value whatsoever.
Thank you, Senator. The question I'm going to have, and Senator Kent be right there, I want to know how you got the 315 and the 525 and the 325 there, and then the age rate is the same for F-150. Okay, Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I misread the chart in the first place. So in the age rate, basically it's the math to keep it the held harmless that delivers that starting base number. Is that correct? And there's no distinction between vehicles.
Madam Chair, members, that is correct. So for the age race, just to kind of walk through the logic, we're trying to get to revenue neutral by charging people over 12 years just based on age, and so we essentially backed into where it has to start. So that $315 in year one is so that every single vehicle over 12 years pays that exact same rate, which is why the Camry and the F-150 are the same. It's backed into to maintain revenue neutral.
Okay, I think now I've got the foundation of the how you got to the starting point.
So again, Madam Chair,
yes.
To maintain the revenue neutral part of this, but look at other scenarios, such as maybe a choice would be to keep that Camry at a certain level, maybe not have the pickup truck come down so fast, it would take additional revenue, and it does add complexity to any sort of scenario of programming and implementing the system. So, you know, this is kind of a very in a bubble. Each of these scenarios is in the bubble of revenue neutral and just kind of just the facts. And then we go from there. I think that's the next step.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think one of the things that I was looking at in looking back at your original chart was that, if I recall right, let's go back to, I'm going to try and find the one, the pickup truck original data, if I can find that one now. Page 3, yes. So the passenger vehicles are 49.6. Pickup trucks are 14.8. So when I look at your presentation here, it looks as though the change from the pickup trucks are 22.7, passenger are 59.4. It looks like on your age-based comparison that I'm trying to look and see if we've kept the proportional percentages of the two types of vehicles as we have right now.
So, Madam Chair, the example is illustrative for a new F-150.
Okay.
That million pickup trucks runs the gamut of value and age. So a lot of those pickup trucks are going to be old and are currently paying the $35 and everywhere in between. So this, across the entire fleet of vehicles, maintains revenue neutral. Each individual vehicle will be impacted differently across both passenger vehicles and pickups. And so for this example, a new F-150 would pay less because right now they're paying on value of an expensive pickup truck, and they would transition to paying based on age. But old pickup trucks would likely pay more.
Okay. Anybody else questions or? Okay, I think that takes care of. I'm just a little bit puzzled at the starting being the same for the pickup and the car, though the value of the vehicles are generally, so that's all. I'm just trying to figure that through.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, again, to what the Commissioner said, this is no impact of value whatsoever. It's just based on age. So every new year one vehicle pays the same $315. And so an expensive F-150 that currently pays $500, $525 in year one would go down to $315. And again, these are in a bubble in isolation. This is completely age-based. That's it.
Okay. And again, this is the removal of the hold harmless. Okay. All right. Without any others for now, we can go ahead to the value-based rate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if we transition to purely a value-based rate, so again, this is just value in a bubble for passenger vehicles and pickups to maintain the existing revenues, you would tax every vehicle at 0.48% of the vehicle's value. And again, this is over the first 12 years, and then in year 13, we would go to that same minimum $35 tax. So there is some attempt to connect it back to the existing structure for old vehicles and just apply these new assumptions to years 1 through 12.
I would say one of the biggest things is, where do you get the base value? Where does that number come from?
So, Madam Chair, we are currently working under the current statute, so it's base value, so MSRP plus destination charge, based on the data we received from DPS.
You just said MSRP. I don't know if we start with MSRP, do we? Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the calculation for base value is that lowest MSRP as well as the destination charge. So it's a two-prong approach, so that's where. If that lowest base value was, $29,000, the destination charge is $1,000, it would be then that taxable value at $29,000.
So on the value base rate, you're assuming the MSRP plus the destination charge?
Madam Chair, that is correct. This is working under, I'll back up this, that's fair that this is confusing. So we assumed hold harmless goes away to maintain revenue neutrality because these are significant changes, and if we left it, it would be very difficult to get back to revenue neutral. However, we did leave existing statute for value. So it's the current value we received for each vehicle from DPS, which includes that destination charge still. So it's still base value for what we're using for this scenario.
Right, but Mr. Nehrud-Hubinger, I would say current statute, according to OLA report and everything that we heard in our last meeting, was anywhere from 6 months to 18 months behind in knowing what that is, unlike the MSRP. Very, very big difference. So I just want to be sure what the definition of base value is in your scenario here right now.
Madam Chair, we are using current law that includes destination charge. So if you remember, if...
So current law, base value in all of the messy affair that it is.
Correct.
Madam Chair.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you. I feel the need to emphasize that the current base value shall not include the cost of each accessory or item of optional equipment. So it's not the sticker price on the car. It's the sticker price of the least expensive vehicle of that type that you could buy. And that's one of the things that makes it so difficult.
Thank you, Representative Elkins. That's exactly my point. I wanted to be really, really clear that this scenario is under current law with all of its issues that we had a big discussion about last time, and is part of the reason why this whole task force has come to be is because of that, and our goal to get to something more simple. But you're using this. Is, from what I see here, so you have not run a scenario of using the MSRP as a proposal?
Madam Chair, that is correct. Although you can pretty simply get to those, it's across the entire fleet, it would be that destination charge going away. So you'd lose about 1% revenue in any of these scenarios if you used MSRP instead of base value. That's very simplistic, but...
So, Mr. Nehrud-Hubinger, you would say then that 1% added on, it would have to be spread out on the other 99% in order to adjust for the lack of the destination charge moving to a MSRP true type system?
Madam Chair, that is correct. So any of these scenarios would have to be adjusted slightly upwards to maintain that revenue neutral. But again, it would be 1%.
Okay. Senator Kent, did you?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for bearing with us while we're catching up on these calculations. I really appreciate that these are each very clean snapshots of a scenario. Obviously, you're not in a position to second guess how we might redefine the base value, that sort of thing. So, you know, I appreciate why we're sticking with current law, even though we've established that there are problems there. So I think this is a really helpful exercise for us to be able to evaluate each of these scenarios cleanly, if you will, and put us in a position to have a more meaningful conversation of how we would want to structure this moving down the road.
Thank you, Senator Ken. I think that's why it's so important to understand what the assumptions are, because if we don't have a good understanding of what this is, we can't. It makes it very difficult to go further. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another observation I would make is that if we actually went to MSRP as it appears on the car, less destination charges, the inclusion of the options and accessories, including those in the value, might very well completely offset deducting the destination charges. And I would like to, you know, see that run as an option the next time we meet as well, because I suspect it would probably come out a wash. It would be a lot simpler. I see a lot of nodding hands over there, which is reassuring.
Right, and that ultimate goal is to come to a point that for programming, for our public understanding, everything else, getting the data accuracy and all those things that are there, absolutely. So I would say, Commissioner?
Madam Chair, I want to clarify one piece of data, whether we have the data right now or then we would need the data actually from the Department of Revenue. And that is that my understanding is that the sales tax is paid on which portion of that? Because that's, I think, the question. Is it MSRP or is it the sticker price? Do we know? right off?
Phone a friend here?
Yeah.
Because
if we don't have that data, we'll need that data to run that scenario.
Ms. Smith?
Madam Chair and Commissioner, I don't know that that would work either because the MVEST or the sales tax is collected on the price paid, so that's minus the trade-in.
Okay, but the MSRP would be irregardless of a trade-in. Is that a correct assumption? Go ahead, Ms. Backus.
Madam Chair, that wouldn't be correct either because that price on the MVEST would include any rebates or things like that that are taken off. That's not part of the MSRP. So incentives, rebates, any kind of that would be off the MSRP. So it's definitely not an apples and apples to get that information from revenue.
Ms. Smith, did you want to add to that?
Madam Chair, I think the hardest thing to find is MSRP. Even if we take the MSRP on new cars, it's all the vehicles that are coming into Minnesota from other states that we have to find an MSRP and a destination charge. So it's not just new vehicles, it's also used vehicles that are coming in or rental vehicles that are coming in, lease vehicles coming in. So this makes it very difficult, and then we wouldn't be looking at the sticker price. We would be looking at MSRP, correct? Not the sticker with all the options or, I mean, there's a difference in those fees, which then changes. I mean, we would have to ask every customer coming in, do you have a 7-inch screen or nav or whatever, you know, to kind of cover that destination fee that we would be losing.
Okay, Commissioner?
I think that's the question is, does the sticker price exist anywhere in collected data? Because to get to Representative Elkin's point, which is a theory that if you based this on sticker price but took away the destination fee, maybe that essentially is a hold harmless. But we won't know that. And if the data doesn't exist somewhere in the system for the sticker price, which right now I'm gathering it does not exist anywhere, that is going to be an impossible task without some sort of model, more trusting a model that we don't have actual data.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just from my experience, when you buy a car and you bring a used one in, there's just so much manipulation of those numbers, giving more money for a trade-in versus less value there versus rebates versus negotiation. To me, it just gets very muddy on using that amount because they're just so, can be so manipulated at all times of a sale, especially on a used car. New car is pretty easy. The sticker's there. You can go by that. But 3 years after that's done and you're trading a car from out of state or a rental car, something you have purchased, to me it just gets very confusing. The data's not there. And in an effort that we're trying to simplify the system, it just seems almost worse to be basing it off that.
Thank you, Senator Jasinski. Representative Elkins, I'll go to you next. One question I want to talk about, though, is commonly known sales price plus trade-in, so that those two together, if there's not a trade-in, you have a sales price, which is a fixed amount that's set, and then trade-in as well. I don't know if that makes any difference or not. Representative Elkins, you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the things that I don't see addressed in this presentation, maybe we can get it to next time, but the question of what data sources do we actually have that we can rely on, and is there a data source, whether it's Vintelligence or something else, that we can match to what's on the sticker on the car, both when the car is new and historically when the car is used? And we really haven't gotten an answer yet as to what reliable data sources do you guys actually have to rely on that we can is available at the time the car is sold and will match to something that we can easily define in a statute.
Very Very good question. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to provide some clarification. So the challenge we have is taking that lowest MSRP. So that's based on, so for example, looking at a Ford F-150, you've got it everywhere from a series, that XL, that basic two-door, two-wheel drive, to a limited vehicle where the MSRP on a limited Super Crew is $64,272, versus that regular cab two-wheel drive is $27,700. So that information we get from Polk. So we do get that information based on the model. So that's broken out in the VIN. So in the 17-digit VIN descriptor, fields 5 through 7 kind of dictate in regards to that MSRP. What model are you buying, or what trim level, what series are you buying? So that really dictates to us what is that amount. The challenge with Minlars, though, is so using that Super Crew Limited, that 64,000, we have to go back to what was that lowest. I mean, so that's where kind of those variables kind of come into play. So we do receive the data based on that MSRP, or excuse me, based on the VIN. We'll drive that MSRP, and that's all broken by the VIN.
Mr. Anderson, you're speaking very softly with a lot of data that's very important. Okay. So can you go back over
forward.
That again and really speak into that microphone?
Great. Thank you. Sorry for the confusion there. So with the 17-digit VIN, fields 5 through 7 dictate to us what is that vehicle trim? What is that model? What are you buying? So in the example I talked about for that F-150, you've got your Ford F-150 XL. So that's your basic two-wheel drive, you know, two-door vehicle. You then have anything, you know, varies to XL, XLT, Lariat, King Ranch, Platinum, Raptor, and Limited. So the most expensive, based on that VIN descriptor, is $64,000. So there's a variance there in regards to that. So the challenge we have with Minlars is, what is the model, or what are we going from for that base amount? Are we going from that Ford F-150 XL, or are we going from the lowest for the XLT? Are we going for the lowest of that Lariat? I mean, of that specific type of model. So that's some of the challenges we have. If we go directly from an MSRP, we receive that from Polk. So Polk will tell us what that MSRP is for that specific vehicle based on the VIN descriptor. And that VIN descriptor, like I mentioned, falls into fields 5 through 7. So you've got F1C, for example, for that lowest, that two-wheel drive, to a W1E. So in that 17 digits, that kind of dictates that dollar amount to us. That, you know, within the VIN, it also tells you, you know, what's the make, what's the restraint system, you know, the engine type, there's a check digit, the model year, where was it manufactured, and then a specific sequence identifier for each of those vehicle types. So that VIN really kind of decodes a lot for us. And if we move away from that lowest base, that's where some of the challenges and issues we've had with Minlars really kind of came into play.
Okay, so if you do away with that lowest base, which mm-hmm. is current law, then you just fall back into that VIN data pool, which does have the MSRP by certain classes with trim packages and so on?
That is correct. If we go away from that base, it will go from that MSRP for that specific vehicle on their VIN. And if that information is not in Polk, we would then, you know, potentially look at, do we have the window sticker? So you've got the window sticker in that vehicle when you buy it new. Do we require then, you know, the dealerships to, you know, provide that to the deputy registrars? You know, those are some of the, you know, kind of the questions, you know, at hand. But the availability of that MSRP based on VIN for you know, vehicles, you know, 2019s and such, as, you know, it's consistent. It's, you know, 99% there. Some of the newer models, so you get into the 2020s, you know, that's where we have some of the gaps. You know, it's not a lot, but for example, in the example of a, drawing a blank on it, electric vehicle, the Tesla, you know, it took quite some time for Tesla to have that information in Polk.
Is that the truck?
The Tesla company, yeah, exactly. Nope.
Even I've seen the disasters. Yeah, I'm sorry. Couldn't help it.
So thank you, Madam Chair. I hope that helps.
Great. Thank you. Yes, Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the problems, and Tony addressed this a little bit, is that vehicles are brought out of rental fleets. So a 2019 may roll into Minnesota, and we won't have window stickers. And a lot of times, and it's Tesla for sure. They're a hand-built car company, but Subaru, many of the import vehicles are slow to get data into Vintelligence and the third-party software that we use. So even though it's a vehicle that's out there, it had a window sticker and is now coming to the state, we still can't get that information. People don't have the window stickers. They can't go get that information. So even though many, many vehicles, I'm going to say probably 90-plus percent, are accurate and available to us as far as at least MSRP, we still walk into them every day where we don't have anywhere to even start. And the state's guideline in our procedures is to refer to, like, Kelley Blue Book and Cars.com and things like that. They don't have it either because the manufacturers have not physically provided that data to those companies for us to use as a reference. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hines. That's very helpful. Ms. Smith?
To follow up with Mike here, Madam Chair, is the big difference that we have on the MSRP when it's sold on the lowest MSRP, you sell that vehicle, and the next MSRP that comes up when you're transferring it and it's running its Vintelligence, it's changing. It's either higher or lower. So that is part of the issue that we're having right now with Minlars is when the vehicle has been transferred, they come in and now they have a renewal notice that says one amount and it has increased and it's saying another amount because that MSRP went up. So I don't know why that's happening, but it seems like that MSRP is changing from the manufacturer.
Interesting. Okay, Representative Elkins, I'm going to take Representative Tabke there first.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question on the value base, the next slide there, as to you are using the initial base value for each year as it goes through. As we look at this, what decisions were made to use that initial base value as opposed to what a current base value would be for each year? So it would include the depreciation, so it would reduce that over time instead of just using the initial base value. But I understand that it's that age is not a comparison, but the age, the value is directly related to the age over time.
Mr. Natarud-Hubinger.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Very close. Representative, right now, these scenarios are completely in isolation in bubbles. So right now, the value based is on that original base value. That's it. It's fixed over the life. Obviously, if this task force wants to look at hybrid scenarios of some combination of depreciation schedule and age and value all rolled into one, we can certainly provide that.
Okay. Representative Elkins.
Okay. I think we've just spent the last 15 minutes confusing matters. So,
Representative Elkins, I feel a clarification coming.
Well, I hope so. So, Tony, you, as you know, I looked up my own car in Vintelligence, and I found a value that was labeled MSRP. What I want to know is that value for my vehicle that I found in the Vintelligence database similar to what we consider base value in our current law, or is it what should appear on the sticker on the car when it's new?
Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and then make sure, let me know, sir, if I'm going awry. So with the base value in your specific situation.
No, we're not talking about base value. Forget about base value. That value that was in the Vintelligence database that was labeled MSRP for my car, is that closer to the value that would appear on the window sticker on my car had it had one, or is it equivalent to the base value as we define it in law? Or is it something else entirely?
Mr. Anderson, so Representative Elkins, it was that last little piece that I think you gave a or. Is it closer to the...
Yeah, in the Vintelligence database, there is an MSRP value that is specific to my individual vehicle, mm-hmm. which was, you know, set at the and when it was new and should not change over time at the granularity of that individual vehicle. But is that vehicle what I would have seen on the sticker, or is that a value that is more akin to what we refer to as base value in current statute?
Okay, Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would definitely need to do some legwork to understand it completely, but my assumption is be closest to that sticker. So if you had that window sticker in your vehicle,
yep,
it would have been tied more closely to that sticker than that lowest amount, because that sticker value and that the Vintelligence amounts, let's say someone else purchased a different model that had less options, you'd be paying less on that base value. But that specific number, when you looked up your record for MSRP, would be most closely aligned to the sticker value, just with the assessment I'm making right now.
Right. So if I went to sell that car in 5 years, that value wouldn't change in the Vintelligence database, would it?
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the amount in Vintelligence possibly could. We've seen fluctuations with MSRP from Polk, as Ms. Smith alluded to earlier. However, if I would purchase your vehicle, I would be paying from that base value that was originally set here in Minnesota. That's the intent.
That's the hold harmless, Mr. Anderson, though, right?
No.
That would be the. Thank you, Madam Chair. That would be that that base value of the vehicle stays throughout the life of that vehicle. It shouldn't change. You know,
right.
That $75,000 shouldn't go from $68,000 or anything.
So,
like that.
Mr. Anderson, once it is established in our system, in the DVS system, and at that value, that will be fixed, even if the Vintelligence might differ.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's where some of the comments by Ms. Smith and
Mr. Hines. We're so glad you're here.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Mr. Anderson, he is correct, except when those vehicles go out of state and come back in, that value will change. And that happens a lot with repossessions. Since Minnesota is not very fast at getting titles out or don't supply the titles immediately, we see a lot of repossessions going to those title states. And those vehicles never leave Minnesota, but they're an out-of-state title. So then when they're coming back in and it runs through Vintelligence again, it gives a different base value.
Okay, follow-up question for you, Ms. Smith. When it comes back in a different base value, is that a large amount, small amount variation? How large is that difference?
It's usually a larger amount. I've never seen it go backwards, but anywhere from $2,000 to $6,000. Yes.
Okay. That's important to know that too. Mr. Hines.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When I joined the task force, I went out and bought a new car just to prove some points. I'm just kidding. But I did
so
actually.
So the rest of the task force, how do we all fare?
I want to be involved in my work directly.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Hines.
I did just buy a new vehicle, and so when we were just talking about this, we use, because we don't, as deputy registrars, don't actually have a subscription to Vintelligence that's a jurisdictional-level product. We use a website called Decode This, which basically can be used for any VIN. You put in the VIN, and it spits out a list of what it is, what engine, what drivetrain, what packages, the MSRP, sometimes the destination, and whatever. And the question was asked by Representative Elkins, the value on my window sticker versus what we see in Vintelligence. I did that same comparison with Decode This. And my MSRP on my window sticker, which I have on my phone, is $44,445. In Decode This, it's $44,295. So it's $150 off. That's really close. And that's just looking MSRP. That's the top number on my window sticker and the MSRP on the website that we have to use for those cars that come into state. So that's, I would say, well within accuracy range of what anything we could shoot for. It's way closer than destination. And I also compared, as Representative Elkins mentioned earlier, the possibility of looking at sticker price in lieu of destination. And in my car, the MSRP, the lowest MSRP, was $44,495. My window sticker was $49,800. So that's almost, you know, what is that, $4,000-some-odd. Now you took that destination charge, and you're almost triple that. So that kind of shoots that one down as an immediate answer. But in my vehicle, I have a well-equipped grandma's minivan, and the window sticker is substantially higher than the MSRP. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I know. So at any rate, getting back to what that means to us or to the programming, so what I'm gathering from what you shared, Mr. Hines, that in general, the sticker price reflects more closely the actual value of the vehicle than the MSRP that might be recorded somewhere for that car under the VIN? Is that correct? I need to repeat it so I make sure I understand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a loaded question because, as Amber mentioned earlier, discounts, rebates, incentives at the time, I guarantee I didn't pay anywhere near $49,000 for that minivan, even before my trade. So what's in the window sticker, like buying jewelry, is not anything that you would want to use as a true value of the product you're purchasing.
Says a Christmas shopping gentleman. Thank you very much. Wise man. So I think when we're, I think the big thing is understanding all that. Representative Elkins, you do quite a bit of research as well. We might as well have you weigh in here.
Madam Chair, what I think I'm hearing is that the value that's reported in Vintelligence is actually closer to what we would define as the base value for the vehicle without the accessories and add-ons than it is to the sticker price. But if it's consistent and reasonable and accessible, you know, I think that's one of our key objectives, is to get something that's practical and can be consistently applied. And if it stays relatively constant, with the exception of some of these odd cases that Ms. Smith, you know, talks about, and is available for used cars as well, you know, the original value that was assigned when the car was first registered, I think that's a plus as well.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Elkins. I want to follow up before I get to you, Senator Kent, to Ms. Smith. So if when the new vehicle registration system is live and running and the assumption is that those titles would be issued more promptly, some of those special cases might go away. Would that be possible, Ms. Smith?
I don't know if we would have that quick of turnaround. That is hopeful. Mm-hmm. But it's also that there are so many types of makes and models of vehicles that we don't have a base value for until probably into the second or third month of that next year. And they're already selling the 2020s in July, August, and we don't have anything for that from that manufacturer until much later.
So, Ms. Smith, that's under current law?
That is, you know, the only thing we have to go by is base value. So we count on the dealer to give us what that would be, because we don't have it from VIN.
But each, okay, Ms. Smith, but each one of those would have a VIN.
Yes.
Wouldn't be sold without a VIN, and there would be then a value or all those things that go in with a VIN. Representative Petersburg, I had already committed to Senator Kent, and then I'll come to you. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to go back to something that Mr. Hines said, because I heard him say something about the fact that the deputy registrars do not have access to Vintelligence, and so you're using this other system. And I don't know if this is something we can go into today, but I think this is something we probably want to make sure we understand. If there's a jurisdictional issue, what do we need to do to make sure that all entities have access to a uniform set of information, because it sounds like that could be a really significant problem in some of the discrepancies that we're finding on these values.
Thank you, Senator Kent. I picked up on that as well. Another issue for us to deal with. Let me ask you this. So, Ms. Smith or Mr. Hines, what would, when you talk about Vintelligence and you're using this other thing, is there something that keeps you from being able to go into a Vintelligence type of system? Is it cost? Is it legal in any way? Can you explain why you don't have access to Vintelligence?
Thank you, Madam
Mr.
Chair.
Hines.
Sorry, I think I'm on. It's a subscription. It's that data. It's a database that someone else controls, and access to that database is charged by subscription. So even the one that we use in our office, Decode This, if I hit it about a half a dozen times in a day, they shut me down because they know that someone's using it for something other than personal research to purchase a vehicle. So if wherever, you know, if I don't know if it's a National Highway Transportation Safety Administration database. I don't know who manages the mothership of database, but Vintelligence is just another client accessing that database that somebody's got to pay a subscription to operate that client. So it's money. I don't want to pay a subscription to do my job that someone else should be providing me accurate data for.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. I appreciate understanding that. We can't work on the solutions if we don't understand that. And maybe we could put that on the list for our next agenda to maybe dig into that whole Vintelligence. Who gets it? How do they get it? Where do they get it? You know, what's the, like you said, the mothership source to kind of have it? Because you're absolutely right, Senator Kent, that, and Mr. Hines as well, we ought to have one that everybody uses. And that's one of those little things, again, that's kind of coming out in the process of our work here in the task force. Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair, again. So when I looked up my vehicle, it was from a different website than Decode This, but it had access to the Polk data. So my impression, and I suspect that one of you might be able to confirm this, is that Polk is the primary integrator of this data, and they're probably getting it from the various state registrars' offices, supplemented with data directly from the manufacturers themselves. But they seem to be one of two or three big aggregators of this data and the most popular one. But they very clearly have an application programming interface that allows other people to basically tap into the data that they've aggregated and expose it through their own applications, obviously upon payment of some kind of licensing fee. So the websites that both Mr. Hines and I referred to look up our own vehicles are examples of that kind of a data architecture in practice. So I'm guessing that the Vitters team is already exploring a relationship with that and or its competitors, and is studying the application programming interface in a way that would enable us through the Vitters system to expose that information to the deputy registrars, the manufacturers, whoever else needs that information. Would that be a correct assumption?
Mr. Anderson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Polk Vintelligence Solution is one of the industry leaders. There's a handful of kind of larger fish that are kind of in that market. Yeah. And Polk is the one that there's a contractual agreement that the state has. Like I said, are one of the bigger players. You know, you've got Vintech, there's a multitude of them. The correspondence I've had with the representative from Vintelligence or with Polk is they receive the data directly from the manufacturer. But I can confirm that I shared with you kind of the schema of all the different things that are shared. We can get clarification for each of those line items to see where do they get that. Is it from General Motors or is it from Nissan? You mean?
And the other thing we need to know is
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that we our license.
Both
does,
of you need to really speak into your microphones.
Yeah, sorry. So we need to also confirm that our license to use that data also enables us to expose that information to the deputy registrars and the dealers as well.
Well, Representative Elkins and Mr. Anderson, I think that this is going to open up, I think, a subject that would be best wait for the next task force meeting when we can delve a little more deeply into this subject and that our staff here can come more prepared to do that. And I see this as two things. What is the foundation that we use today? What is available to us? You know, what are those data sources? That was a question that was asked. And then I would say the biggest thing is you want to make sure we're all working off the same one, and then how to make that universally available to all the registrars, no matter where they exist. One of the things is someone here from FAST that we could maybe, I'd like to ask you to come up. You thought you could just, yes, listen. But I think I think being able to have information here in regards to this topic, in regards to other states, has this issue come up in other states, that core set of data, in particular around the Vintelligence or something like that? Again, for the audio record, though, let's be sure and get your name and title for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Ken Buna from Fast Enterprises. I'm the project director on the DPS system that we're building. Excuse me. Most of our states use Vintelligence as their source, as the representative mentioned. They are an aggregator of the data. The big problem, as Ms. Smith and Mr. Heinz have indicated, is brand new vehicles, the data is just not available. In the analysis that was done by DOT, you'll see that very few of our states actually calculate it the way that Minnesota does. A lot of them are age-based or weight-based. Age-based takes all of the complications out, but then you say, is it fair that I face pay $75,000 for a vehicle versus $30,000, should I pay the same tax? That's the big problem with age, but the calculation is dead simple. I don't care where you got the car. I don't care if you transferred it. I don't care if you moved from out of state. So Vintelligence is the best that is out there in the industry. There's, as Mr. Anderson mentioned, there are three or four major players, but Vintelligence is the one that's used in most of our vehicle jurisdictions. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you very much. That is very helpful. One of the other questions, though, is does in other states where you're doing this, is Vintelligence readily available, such as to our deputy registrars, to locations other than a state level?
Madam Chair, most of the arrangements or contracts are with the agency itself. So, for example, Vintelligence has a contractual agreement with the Department of Public Safety. We have the rights to use those under our contract, and those are typically based on number of transactions in a year. So I'm not sure what the amount is. Perhaps Mr. Anderson knows, but let's say it's $100,000 a year, and they will say, we allow you to hit our web services 4 million times. So if the state chooses to use our software to allow deputy registrars to just do a blind lookup on their own, we could do that. We would just have to include those counts in our license. And I think we'd have to analyze how much has happened over the last few years. And perhaps it goes from 100,000 to 120,000. I mean, I'm just speculating here. But we could expose Vintelligence to those people very simply through our software.
Thank you very much. That's very helpful. That's probably the bigger question, those two big answers. Commissioner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick clarification. Two clarifications. One, there will be a price for that increased access to a subscription, is my guess. Based on my past experience in the tech world, there's nothing for free here. So let's be clear that if we're going to do that, we're going to pay something. And then the second question is this very basic question. If Vintelligence is the best source of data and the one that's most used by states, Mr. Bana, does that... Where is the underlying source of the data coming from? Where is that sort of metadata come in through into Vintelligence? I still think we've been working on that. Manufacturers only? Other places?
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Designated hitter here.
It is, my understanding comes directly from the manufacturer, but that's something for follow-up I can do for each of those schemas, each of those fields. Where does Polk get that specific information? Because it's spelled out very, very specifically in what we receive from, you know, from whether we capture it in MNLARS. I mean, for example, we receive weight, but we don't capture weight in MNLARS.
Okay, Commissioner. Okay. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And one of the things that I'm a finance person, so I like detail and I like having everything nice and neat. But when dealing with public policy and some of this stuff that is so complex, I think if we're trying to develop a system that is going to give us that kind of detail, we're never going to come to the solution. So I think it's appropriate for us to understand we need to get a ballpark figure out there that everybody can understand and accept. I don't think the issue has been, well, I'm paying $2 more for my tabs than you are over there with the same vehicle. The question is, how come I'm paying $5 and you're paying $500? And that's the issue that we're dealing with. So we need to have a base value or some, excuse me, I'm going to eliminate that word. We need to have some sort of base for every vehicle out there and deal with it. And that's easy for us to explain and deal with it. It sounds like we're getting late data from manufacturers during that first approximately 12 months that the manufacturer is there. So maybe we just have some sort of base value for that year and tell everybody, hey, we're going to adjust accordingly to that on the second year, and then use that data from that point on. But something in which that it's going to be simple for us to be able to deal with, simple for us to talk to the consumer about, and not trying to find, make sure that we are to the penny, accurate and available for everybody, because that's not going to be possible. We need to just hit that ballpark figure and move forward with it, because that's simple.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Appreciate that. I think it's interesting. It isn't right now, so we shouldn't try to make it so in the future. There needs to be recognition that we are way off right now. Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, the last hour and a half has really helped me make my mind up. I still think flat rate is the most simple. I mean, we were in this room. We've been here for an hour and a half, and some people still don't understand perfectly the way it is. They do. I get that, and we can research that. But the public out there that wants to pay these things and doesn't want to spend 6 hours in this room understanding how it's all done, the flat rate or maybe an age-based, something simple that they're out there. And now, the deputy registers, if they don't have the system they have to subscribe to, if they do too many transactions, it's just another fee they're paying, more off their bottom line. It just makes things more confusing to people. And I hate to go back to my days when I was growing up, but I was a bartender, and I used to train bartenders. And there were 6 or 7 different prices on things. Why not just have one price, which we did, and people loved it. They came in, they knew what they wanted, they understand, boom, and you're out the door. It sped everything up. It didn't make it confusing. There was no misinterpretation. You didn't have to rely on another third party or 2 third parties. People understood it. And again, I'm keeping my mind open, but this last hour and a half discussion really is making me say, why in the heck don't we just do a flat rate and be on with it? Because it's going to simplify. We have 25 other states that are doing it. We're one of 7 that does value-based. Maybe that's an indication it doesn't work the best. So, I I'm trying to keep my mind open. I understand we've been in this process for so long, and we got to look at all options. But this flat rate, to me, is a no-brainer. And I don't understand why we'll get to this, and that's what the task force is about. I understand we're going through the process. But after this discussion, it just exemplifies why a flat rate system does not make the most sense for Minnesotans in this state.
Madam, thank you, Senator Jasinski, and yes, Commissioner.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I made a commitment to do a speaking engagement in a little bit here that I have to drive to. So I want to just make it very clear and make sure we have the authority to do this, because people always get concerned about this, is that maybe the next step, I mean, we're going to do a weight-based scenario. That's clear. We're getting the data for that. But if MnDOT could have the clear direction to take those gaps on the chart, if you look at the line graph, that is the gap in the hold harmless under both age and under flat rate. We need to, I think, bring back to you a scenario that would say, if we were going to do a hold harmless provision, a phase-in provision, to that, what would that cost in making sure the transportation system is not harmed in the near term and the long term? And so if I just make sure that our team has the permission to go about that, I would feel much better leaving the room, and I'm sure all will be well.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think that was a very good idea. I would just say that's the whole point sometimes. If having an hour and a half, just like we did the last one as well, once you understand all of those complexities, but you don't know that until you have that discussion. So it's kind of a process you have to go through, even if you may come to that. And as you know, in the legislature, process is a big part of the whole system. At any rate, Commissioner, and to members of the task force, Ms. Smith, I see your hand raised. I think because she has to go, and understanding that, and hearing from Senator Sinske and others as well, to take this the next step, right? This is kind of initial information. So the weight-based in particular is the one you're waiting for data on, which has been mentioned as one of those. I think the value-based, and we've had quite a thorough discussion about that regard. And then the other one is the flat rate. And so in taking age and flat to that greater detail and also adjusting for the hold harmless both ways, to the road fund and to our taxpayers who feel they have a contractual situation of that situation, at least grandfathering, you know, kind of working them out. Is it possible? Can we do all of that? And you'd like to work with the staff to come up with that for our next meeting. Okay. If I can restate it and you say yes, I'm yes, you've done a really good job. Okay. Ms. Smith.
The one area I'm concerned about is the electric vehicles. Because when that law first started, the initial intent, I think, was to add $75 onto the price of those tabs. And since they couldn't pay anything more than they paid the year before, we sat there at the deputy offices trying to deduct the $75 from their tabs and trying to figure out which part we had to put it in, whether it goes in registration or whatever. So, and especially since you have said that 20% more are looking at the electric side, we want to make sure that we don't also want to decrease for our roads and bridges either on that end. And was that $75 supposed to be added onto the price of the tabs, or did we have to deduct that? I know that's many questions.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. I think the subject of the electric vehicle is certainly relevant. Commissioner, did you want?
Madam Chair, I think electric vehicles warrant a whole nother discussion. I don't know that it has to be the next one, but many states are doing a variety of these types of things. I know we looked at our neighboring states, but I do know from my work with our national group that most states are now moving to maybe a little higher rate, 250 and 150 or 250 and 125, the fully electric. And my understanding is that is an add-on to any registration fee, because what it's meant to do is try to at least have some approximation of the gas taxes not paid, since we also don't have a system to do the valuation on the electricity that's being gathered there for the vehicle. That is also an issue. So I think we could do a whole thing on how that works. But adding on, I do not believe it's a subtraction. And I think the statute's probably pretty clear on that.
Well, I would concur, Commissioner, but I think by virtue of the discussion, it is not universally being understood that way, and I don't know that that is statutory. It may be just a clarification. So I'll get you, Representative Elkins, so probably for the next agenda, but Commissioner, I understand you need to leave, and thank you very much. Thank you very much. And so I would like to get through the PowerPoint, because it has some feasibility, possible, difficult, some other things that I think might be helpful. And I always feel when they work this hard to come up with these things together, we owe them at least to get through their whole PowerPoint. But before we do that, Representative Elkins, do you want to? All right, let's go through then. And we're back to page 18, I believe, the feasibility analysis. Or was there a slide before that?
Madam Chair, I believe we're on slide 34. Just to clarify the comments about electric vehicles, when that $75 was added on, that hold harmless subdivision was amended as well. And so that language, that paragraph, that subdivision 1M that's referenced in hold harmless is that $75. So it did get changed to include that.
Okay. And also, in the next time there is a presentation, you've heard a lot of questions about the assumptions and some of those kinds of things, just to make sure you add all of that in. And members, I keep forgetting to mention this. This material was supposed to have gone out to you last Friday, but as you know, it was a holiday and getting all the data together. There was a technical issue with LCC, and due to both weather and holiday, they were not able to do that. And with our meeting right away here at 9 o'clock this morning, I just wanted you to know that's why I would prefer for you to have this at least 3, 4, 5 days in advance so you can take a look at it better. But today is just the way we need to do it. With that, if you could go ahead and continue your presentation on the slides.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to turn it over to Tony. Thank you for bearing with all the numbers to this point.
Thanks, Josh.
We only have a couple slides to go.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. So the slide here is based on weight-based rate. So a request has been submitted to Polk and to receive that data. A contract amendment has been submitted to them because we currently have a contract with Polk. So once the contract amendment is signed, we've got a file that's ready to be transmitted and get that data back from Polk for the weight-based for the passenger vehicles and pickup trucks that we've talked about. On the next slide here, this is the feasibility analysis. So we've talked quite a bit about the different options here today.
Okay, can you speak into that microphone again?
Yep.
And which one? You're on slide 36 now?
We're on slide 36 now, correct.
Okay, good. Thank you.
So on slide 36 here is we have the feasibility analysis. So we've talked about the flat rate, value-based, age-based, weight-based. The reason why that's difficult is currently we do not have that data, but that request, like I said, has been made, and we're just waiting for that contract to be signed.
Let me clarify. When you talk about weight-based, that's based on current data, but that is something you're working on? So that this is the snapshot as of today, but not necessarily permanently so?
Correct. That is correct, Madam Chair. Currently, we do not have that weight for passenger vehicles.
As of this day?
As of today.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's red.
All right.
And we've got minimum tax, and then the alternative is the different options we've talked about here today. On the next slide here are some gaps in statute that we've come across with the replacement of MNLARS. The first two we've kind of talked about here quite a bit during the presentation, and that is in regards to the calculation of base value, as well as the that we've referred to as kind of that hold harmless. An opportunity for us with the project to kind of clear things up is we've got some kind of some challenges with the definition of, with the replacement of a dealer plate. So we know currently if you buy 1 through 4 plate, you pay $75. However, let's say one of those plates gets stolen or one of those plates gets wrecked in an accident. It's silent in regards to what do we default to? Do we default to the standard plate replacement cost or is it that $75? So looking for kind of clarification there, kind of like I said, a stopping point in statute. And the other one is clarification on the definition of one-ton truck. So there's some kind of loose ends there where we're kind of having some challenges over the years with MNLARS, but while we're going through that replacement, here's some opportunities for us to kind of clear things up to make it better for the citizens of Minnesota. A couple more opportunities, tiny homes, so the titling of tiny homes. Currently, tiny homes are either titled as a recreational trailer or commercial trailer, so kind of not really having a home, so recommending some sort of a definition in regards to a tiny home, and where does it fall into? And then the other bullet on the screen here is the authority for DVS to update incorrect base value. So we've talked about that throughout the presentation here today, as well as within that OLA report, and that's for that, you know, that $2 base value for that set, for that example that we've talked about for the F-150, or to have the ability to make corrections. And then on the final slide here is a recommendation to change the location and layout of our temporary permit. So currently in Minnesota, we have two different permit styles. When you buy a vehicle from a dealer, you get that yellow slip of paper that's taped in the back window. Too often, window is tinted, so that visibility is limited from law enforcement. Plus, that information is not in MNLARS. And second permit is issued by typically the deputy registrar offices, and that's just an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper that the individual has their vehicle, so they're bought a vehicle in Minnesota, moving Transport in Wisconsin that keep in the vehicle. So looking at a opportunity to consolidate clear up and kind of make kind of that public safety of the permit better. So you got two different options on the screen here that we've talked about in the projects. We got one with Colorado Method and then the other with New Jersey. So the Colorado Method is a kind of a backing board that's mounted to the back of the vehicle, and then the New Jersey model is more of like a tear-resistant paper. These would go on the back bumper. Recommendation is on that back bumper. And that control number that you see, so either that 021-826N or the H683169, that would be assigned by FAST. So when we are doing that transaction for that permit, that is live data. So law enforcement would be able to query that information and know exactly who that, what vehicle the owner of that vehicle is, who are they walking up upon, tollways and stuff like that add value to them as well. So those are kind of the three slides in regards to, with a project, some opportunities to streamline legislation for the project. Any questions in regards to the couple slides I went through?
Great. We got them through. That's very good, and that's helpful information as well. Any conversation here from members?
Yeah.
Representative Elkins?
Thank you. I wanted to let him get through these because my comments are really addressed at this as well. So you guys seem to be kind of working almost under the assumption that everything changes, stays exactly the way it is, and currently, including the current definition of base value in state law, when I think we have a consensus around this table that that's not workable and we're not going to stick with that. And what I would encourage you to do is just come back and tell us the next time, what is in the available data you've got, what is the best, you know, source of value that is most widely available, most consistently applied, and tell us how we would define that value in state law. And let's back into it that way. Similarly, with the current hold harmless clause in state law is causing all kinds of problems. I don't assume that we're going to keep that the way it is. It's just not workable at all, and just creates more problems than it's worth. Those are the main things for coming back. I mean, I think the stuff on the last couple of slides, we didn't get a chance to look at this in advance. We probably would have had more questions. I don't agree with Senator Jasinski that the flat rate would be best, just simply because in all of these scenarios, changing from something like what we have now, value-based, to a flat rate, it would be hugely regressive. It would be an immense windfall for somebody like me who has a new expensive car. And I think when you do this next analysis, it's going to show that there are enormous rate increases on people who have older, less valuable cars under any scenario. And I think your analysis is probably going to tell us that the revenue gap of including a hold harmless in that is going to be enormous.
Thank you very much, yes. Representative Elkins. Senator Kent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate Representative Elkins' comments there. I was running the math on this, and essentially there is a slight, if we go with a flat rate based, and we know this is just a straight analysis, but that's why we've been given these very clean snapshot scenarios. The Camry scenario, a $26,000 vehicle, that over the 13-year life of the vehicle comes down about 5%, but on the more expensive vehicle at $42,000, that comes down to 40% from where it was on the life of the vehicle. And so that is a significant shift of the burden of this onto people who have more modest vehicles from people who have more expensive vehicles. So I do think that's important to note. I appreciate the need for simplicity, and I think we can strike a healthy balance in there somewhere. I do think, coming back to one of the points that Representative Elkins made in terms of asking for your feedback on this one. Hang on, I lost my note there when I was looking at that one chart. Forgive me, too many notes. Not finding it. Sorry. I will follow up. So thank you.
Okay. All right. Well, I think that...
Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'm sorry.
Senator Kent.
Looking over at you, I saw Representative Petersburg, and I remembered what it was.
Okay, no problem.
Well, Representative Petersburg had a really good point in terms of making sure that we provide clarity to Minnesotans with whatever we do. And that is the kind of thing that I think also, if you guys could come back and talk about what that could look like in terms of statute and recommended language, similar to what Representative Elkins was bringing up on the other side. Thank you for your patience, Madam Chair, and for your reminder, Representative Peters.
Okay, thank you very much. So, members, I think that we will be looking to have another meeting here for that kind of data. Michelle, what is the time frame that you think of? Commissioner is not here, but staff here as well. What amount of time do you need in order to come back to us with something put together on some of these scenarios? Is this a two-week scenario or?
Madam Chair, I would say it's very contingent on when we receive the detail weight data. So I would look to Mr. Anderson to estimate that date, and we would need a couple days of analysis to turn the scenarios around, in addition to addressing some of the questions that the task force members have already raised and providing additional scenarios. So,
thank you, Michelle. And also add a few days to get it out and get it to the members so you can review it before the meeting. So, Mr. Anderson, do you want to respond to the timing of all of what was mentioned here?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The timing for getting the data, so, for example, right before the hearing started here today, got an email from Polk, and as soon as they received the data, they would be able to turn it within a week. This is dependent on them signing the signing that contract, though, because it's a contract amendment. Because of the cost associated with getting that additional data. So as long as Polk is able to sign it, it'll be about approximately a week out. So I can do follow-up with your staff in regards to where they're at with
it. So what are we kind of looking at then? Main thing is that we got a holiday in front of us, so are we better off waiting? I don't know if we have any choice. If the data plus putting things all together just may not be possible to do it before the Christmas holiday.
Recommendation would be at least 2 weeks in regards to getting that data and having that data being able to
at least
be
2 weeks
sent.
Just to get the data.
Just to get the data would be my recommendation. Like I said, it's dependent on the signature for that contract. So we're dealing with kind of that sales rep. It needs to go through their contractual process for their signature. So we've got everything in. When I say we, working with Minute and DPS contracts, we have everything to them. They've had it for some time before the holiday, but.
Okay, we're looking at 2 weeks for that, a week for staff to do that, get it out in time. I just don't know that we can reasonably do this. It's a very short window this year between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Obviously, between Christmas and New Year's, not going to work for a majority of people, and so we're looking after that. And that very first week of January is sometimes a little tough as well, so I think that second week in January, from all practical aspects, would be the most feasible at this point.
Madam Chair, can I ask a clarifying question?
Mr. Yes.
In terms of scenarios you're looking for, so we'll provide a clean weight-based scenario to compare to these existing three. Is this task force looking for a recommended hybrid of the combining those into some kind of a reasonable or recommended scenario?
I think that's a good question. I think let's make probably a scenario or any scenario that gives us, I think the data needs to be certain. We need to be able to have some measure of certain data. Now, if it's the VIN intelligence type of thing and we come up with that first year, the first 12 months, or we come up with a category that we can make it finite just by virtue of either statute or something like that, so you create that certainty in an uncertain kind of situation that is doable. In any one of those categories, we're looking for scenarios to put forward that give us that. And if you can anticipate that and say, we plugged in, and again, you're plugging it in, it's a draft. And folks, when people do a lot of work to do a draft, they're doing their best guess of what we might think. So we're going to respect that. The big thing is to just know what those things were and where you got the data from so we can interpret it from there. I think that's an important part. I think the our current model, I don't know if we want to deviate that much from 40% down here or whatever, but sometimes there's options. In the first 3 years, it's this flat rate. In the next 3 years, it's this flat rate. So sometimes there's some ways you can modify that to help alleviate it without just an absolute black, white, this or that. Those are the kinds of scenarios with their kinds of things. Senator Jasinski?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just following up, because I was thinking it before you said it, so, I understand Representative Elkins' point and Senator Kent on the flat rate, but as you're going on that, one of my thoughts was, is a flat rate for 0 to 10 years and a flat rate from 10 and on, and maybe we try and keep that more on the 10-year and beyond, because that's the effect a lot of people that have on the lower end of those cars. So you had, or a staggered flat rate like that, because I think that discussion may simplify things a lot, accomplish what we're trying to do here, both to keep it simple, but to keep it fair, and something along those lines would be a nice option that I would like to say. I don't know if the rest of the board likes that as well, but I think that does really bring up a good point.
Thank you, Senator Jasinski. Representative Elkins? Representative Tapke, yes.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. As we look forward to how we get this task force done and everything completed, because we have to have it done by February, correct? We have to have it done by the beginning of session?
Well, the statutory date for us to come out with a recommendation is, January 15th.
So January 15th. So we're looking at 6 weeks left here to get this done. And as we're spending money to pull information on weight data and those types of things, at what point do we just say where we're at today is something that we're willing to work with and to tweak and make the fixes with regard to how we calculate the base value and different things like that? Because 6 weeks to me does not seem like enough time to do a wholesale change in the way we handle registration tabs for getting this done by January 15th. And pulling that and fixing what needs to be fixed today and then taking a beat and looking at the rest of it at a different time, because as Senator Jasinski said, politically and personally, we're not going to get anything through the House that reduces the progressivity of our tabs. I mean, it's just not going to happen, so that's not a political solution that's going to work. So as we're looking at this today, can we just, as we move into the next 6 weeks of getting this done, can we take where we're at today and fix what has to be fixed and then come back with future proposals after that to make sure that the system works and make sure that we are fixing what we have to get done? Because 6 weeks to me does not seem like enough time from where we've come since May to get this done feasibly.
Well, thank you, Representative Tabke. But remember that the last meeting we had an in-depth discussion, I think almost 3 hours, just on that whole, is it fixable in the current? I would say that's been a pretty strong conclusion that it's not. It's not because of us, but it's because the source data just fails us in such a way that just isn't really feasible. I think determining at this date whether 6 weeks from now we can or cannot, that's why it's going to be so important that the next round of data that gets presented to us has enough options in there rather than just one or the other. Fine for today, but I think in that next round with all this input, I don't think we should prejudge that next week, the next meeting, I should say, as to whether, because all of these discussions. The other thing is that when we are meeting as a task force, something that I feel very strongly about is we don't make a critical decision without notice to everybody. To kind of do that right now would be kind of making a critical decision without that notice. And I think I appreciate your thoughtfulness of your idea, and that's why I mentioned what are some of those options to kind of keep a similar effect. Maybe not the formula, but the effect. But when you make a change, there may have to be some changes. How can we get from here to there and kind of keep that aligned? I don't think that's impossible with either flat or weight. I think we just need some of the scenarios and the work that they do to give us some of those options that will help stay within those parameters. Representative Tapke.
Yeah, thank you. And I will clarify my question. It was much more that I feel that we are currently running out of time in order to get this done. So when do you expect to, as we look at the next steps, of when do you expect to make that type of decision? Because I don't want all of our incredible talent and people running around making different scenarios and working on a lot of work that doesn't need to be done if it's not going to be critical to our decision-making process. That's what I'm asking. Is it after we get past January 1st? Is it after the next meeting? Like, when, what do we expect as the goals out of our near-term pieces?
Well, Representative Tapke, I see this as probably very valuable to the process and the sequence of things that help to bring us to a great deal of unity, which is really important so that the House, Senate, and the governor and everybody else, we got to get that process in. But I would say at the next meeting is probably where things are going to gel pretty well.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And will the January 15th is a required report, we can do. Here's what we're doing. Here's what we've done. Here's the process. If we don't have a result yet, we will strive very hard to get there. I think there's a chance we could have it on that next one. But even if we do, there is still a tremendous amount of work to fill in those details at that point. I don't know that it's going to be like in cement or something, but I would say somewhere, some way, we might be able to gel around at least narrow things down. I think that's what you're trying to say, is can we get things narrowed down? To take this opportunity and continue the old just seems unacceptable. To go back to our folks back home and say that we didn't do that, I think that's a harder explanation than taking a little bit longer to do it well.
Yeah.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Continuing on the same line, I think that the project team has been hard at work for 6 months now, and all of their development work to date is based upon current law. And if we're going to seriously consider significant change to the basic approach of the rate structure at this point, we're going to impact the project team schedule. And I think we have to be realistic about that. I mean, we should have started meeting back in July as well, because obviously that we've gotten into this, this is a very involved subject. It requires a lot of analysis. But by starting so late, we've painted ourselves into a corner that we cannot make huge changes to the way we do it right now without significantly impacting the project structure. So I think the team, when they come back next month, also has to be positioned to tell us how much time would have to be added to the schedule in order to make a change, a dramatic change to one of these other structures.
So thank you, Representative Elkins. Probably I remember from one of our last meetings when we recognize the fact that we have a company here that has done every kind of scenario already. They already have code from just about every kind of scenario. Certainly contractually, they're doing the best they can, with the current law. But my understanding is that they've anticipated some of this, and maybe this would be a good time for you, Mr. Rana, to be able to give us that kind of impact again of the timing of our decision and development, and if you can just recap or update us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In the famous words of my boss, it depends. It depends on what the direction is. If the decision was it's age-based, I'm not concerned one iota. If it's a massive hybrid of value and weight and age and this and flat and that, then I start to get a little more concerned. But if it is one that we have done before, so we have done age-based before, we have done flat rate before, even destination charge put aside, as we mentioned last time, even the current law and some of the things on there, we are actively building that and are now testing that for passenger vehicles. So unless we come up with something more complicated than what is there today, I'm pretty confident that we will be able to keep our schedule where it is at. And as I recall from the last session, by March 1st was kind of a line in the sand that I mentioned that it would be really good if we at least knew 80% of it by then without it affecting our schedule.
Okay. Thank you very much. That is very helpful for us to have at this time. And so I think in line with that, I think there's going to be a great deal of responsibility placed upon Ms. Rowe and your staff and DVS and MnDOT to take all of this input and come up with scenarios that fit this discussion. And then I think we're going to have to see where we are at in regards to that. And members, what I will propose is to, as early as possible, get a date and time out to you so that we are able to make sure we have all of our members again at the table where it is possible so that we're able to make those due considerations. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just briefly want to just remind this task force that this isn't the final stop. We are going to have a lot of debate in both the House and the Senate. There's going to be a lot of changes, a lot of opportunities for debate through this. So the task force's responsibility is just give the best recommendation, and it'll go from there. So we have a lot more work to do even after this task force completes.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. A good reminder, there is still the legislature, and we are a task force. But the recommendation of this task force will carry a lot of weight. Mr. Hines, and then we're going to adjourn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One thing we were talking about with intelligence and moving forward, even with our weight-based data, is, again, that is provided by the manufacturers. We are at the mercy of the manufacturers and the quality of that data. If Toyota doesn't give it to us, we're still in the same boat we are today. I don't care if it's MSRP, if it's destination, or if it's the weight of the vehicle. So when you're thinking about where do we get that source of information, if they don't provide it to us, we're still in a hole.
Okay. That is an assumption, Mr. Hines, no matter what. But that's a very important consideration to realize. Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, if I could also, too, we need our job, as we were charged, is to evaluate and make a recommendation to what we can do to simplify and possibly improve our registration system. But no matter what, so we get our task force, we give our recommendation that goes to the legislature, and you do your job, and you debate it and figure it out, and you change the laws. Now, November 16th, we're launching a new system, but we also have now a whole new pile of statutes that we have to learn and teach every one of our employees and every one of our dealers and every one of those. So it's not just about what we're going to do to help FAST make a better software program, but whatever we do, it has to be taught to us in that same time window as the deputy registrars. We're the ones that are going to have to be learning all that information, but also the face of the people who are going to have to answer to your constituents when their $35 car went to $138, just as an example. That's coming to us. They're going to ring your phone, too, but we're going to get it first, and then we're going to call. But that is what I'm saying, is that not only are we making recommendations to change FAST, make FAST better, make our system better, but we have a huge burden that's going to be placed on us if it's a dramatic change in the statutory part of it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Appreciate all of that. And members, just to remind you, when we have a discussion, we have a conversation about flat rate and its effects, weight base and all of that stuff, that is not to construe that to negative connotations that were not intended. It's a discussion. In order to have a good, open, and frank discussion, all those things need to be able to be talked about. All right, members, with that, we will see you next year, and thank you for all your time. We are adjourned.